My part of the program is to talk about the church, and I'd like to give Jana more time because I've talked more recently here than she has. The thing I would especially like to focus in on tonight is faithfulness, spirit fruit, faithfulness. And often we can't see the result of faithfulness until a ways down the road. And I can just identify with Jacob in the Bible, who told the Lord, you know, Lord, you have been so faithful. I left with one staff, and now I'm returning with two groups of people. And when Jana and Netho and Bonnie Glick and I went 21 years ago, we, so to speak, left with one staff. And we were very inexperienced. We didn't know the people. And we didn't have a church body. But now the Lord has graciously given us a wonderful church body in El Resbaladero. I'd like to remember and think about how different ones in the church have practiced this spirit fruit of faithfulness under God's power, under God's grace. And I'd like to start with Bonnie Glick, first of all. Bonnie has the personality of a bit more timid, and of course she had, her ministry was not as public as Netho and Jana and mine. But she was so consistent and is consistent in training her 11 children. And it impressed me. 1- and 2-year-olds did not disrespect her. And she was so consistent with them. And now we can see the fruit of her faithfulness. Now she has sons that are 6-foot tall, and their grandmother lovingly calls them the gentle giants, and that's what they are. They're just exceptionally thoughtful and servants. And not only that, they're very spiritually sensitive, which would be Netho's influence too. But the two oldest take turns preaching in the church, and the next two take turns participating with devotionals. And then the fifth one now is starting to lead the singing as well. So they're very involved. And so it's just a real encouragement to be able to see her faithfulness all these years and to see the result of that. I think of another person, Celso Baños, who is our deacon. Celso had the reputation before he became a Christian to promise something quickly but not follow through. And that changed, not immediately, but it did change after he became a Christian. And it wasn't easy because his wife mocked him and opposed him when he wanted to attend our church. But after 3 years, she became a Christian too. And it's just beautiful to see the result of his influence. And because she's just a really wonderful mother and so concerned about her children and a real builder in the church. And is, as well in the community, is very quick to testify. Then I think of Fabio Rodriguez, who is a few years older than Nathan Glick, the oldest son in Netho's family. And Fabio had some difficult experiences when he was young, but Nathan began to faithfully and consistently call Fabio to follow Jesus. And it was through Nathan's influence that he turned his heart to the Lord. And then when when he was married and his wife was not a Christian, but he didn't preach at her. He just lived Jesus. And he's a real family man and is so quick to help her with the children. They have two children, a two-year-old and a three-year-old. And he's as near a mother in male body. He's just so concerned about his children. But then last summer then, she, Ceci, his wife, became a Christian as well. I really like Ceci. She's just your sincere person and honest, transparent. One time after a sermon that she was moved by, she just, and was given opportunity to testify, she just squeezed her eyes shut and just, "I just want you to know that I yelled at my husband this week, and I'm so sorry, and I want God in our family." And, you know, it's just sweet. It was just transparent. And she'll just sit up front sometimes, just wanting to get drink in, hear what's going on in the services. And then I'd like to talk about a family that's very special to me, the Escobar family. Luis, in particular, I'd like to talk about his wife. They're both Christians. His wife is very special to me, is almost like a daughter to me. But Luis's story is that he grew up in a dysfunctional home in that his father was a womanizer. And his mother did healings. And people would come from far away to be healed by her. But he grew up feeling like the black sheep, rejected. And so in order to combat these feelings, negative feelings, then he started drinking and in his teen years. And I don't know exactly how many years it was, but I'm guessing it was around 17 years that he was drinking. And he would use up the family resources, would be strung out on the road, and they sometimes had no food, had to ask for salt. It was that bad. And he'd come home and beat up Guadalupe. Well, 6 years ago, he had a dream, and God in his faithfulness spoke to him in the dream. And he burned his bridges behind him. But my father took a real interest in Luis. He'd just pray and pray for Luis. And he'd ask me, he didn't know how to say Luis, and so he'd ask me, "Now, how's Luis doing?" But he was just really faithful in praying for Luis. So I think about what I've read about the Chinese bamboo tree, that when it's planted, the first 5 years, it remains dormant. And even though it's watered, fertilized, you don't see shoots. But in the sixth year, it can grow up to 60 feet tall in 1 year's time. It needed all the watering. It needed all the fertilizing, just as other plants. And in that sixth year, and I guess I kind of compare Luis to that Chinese bamboo tree, because we didn't see a lot of change in him until about last year. And it was last year that we began to sense that there's a real spiritual battle going on for Luis and his family, and found out that his brothers regularly go to the witchcraft centers, seek help from witchcraft centers. And they all live together. They're kind of huddled together, five households in about that space of what we've got on the east side of the church house. And it seemed like the enemy was just bombarding Luis. And the first thing we saw was that he was hitting his oldest daughter, who was a member of the church, and she, her vulnerability was immoral, ungodly relationships. Then the next thing we saw, next bombardment, was his son. His son became really rebellious, and he's 16 and started hanging out with gangs, which is a real danger to him and to the family and to us too. And then that would have been late spring. And then by summertime, his brother, they started having conflict, or the conflict stepped up with his brother. And the one brother, Luis had planted watermelons. But before it, I should back up to say that the one brother was building a new house, and he wanted to have his wall smack up against Luis's house so that you couldn't even go out that entrance. And when Luis saw that, he talked to him about it. I can't get out. Didn't matter to him. So Luis went to talk to his father, who owns the property, and his father put a stop to it. Well, the brother got really resentful about it. And so when Luis went to plant these watermelons, and they raised, and they were ripe, ready for picking, this brother went out with a machete and his friends and slashed the entire watermelon patch. Nobody knows the exact loss, but we think possibly $200, which is a big amount in El Salvador. And so he came back, and everybody was just shocked, and then Luis's father brought out the pistol and said to Luis, "Here's my pistol. You can use it if you want." And he was really tempted to harm his brother, but he thought about it. That'll get me nothing. He went and knelt down and prayed. And he felt better already. And then after he prayed, he went to find Neto, the pastor. And then he felt a lot better after he talked to Neto. And 3 days later, when he was telling me the story, he said, "I feel really good about it. God has it in his hands. I don't care." And so it's just amazing, that kind of forgiveness in the kind of family he was brought up with. And then all of those bombardments, he said, "I'm going to go ahead and get baptized." And so he was baptized last October. And then this spring then, Neto felt like there's too much tension there with the five households. It'd be better if he'd get his own place. And so we as a church really began praying earnestly about that. And the Lord brought the funds and for him to borrow, and the Lord brought land at a terrific price. So he has his own land now. Well, it's actually Neto's name until he's able to pay it off. But then he was thinking about building, and the church house roof needed to be replaced, so we were going to take the roof off and give that to him. Well, he misstepped, fell through the roof, and broke his pelvic bone. And so it was a pretty big shock for him, and didn't know how he was going to provide for his family, didn't know how he was going to build his house before the rains come. But the Lord just used that fall in amazing ways. It just made him feel God's grace through the church like I don't think he'd ever experienced before. And he just felt so loved. And then as his bones healed, they started thinking about this house, and a neighbor was building another house, and so he offered that he could have the adobes from his house for a really reduced price. And we recognized, this is God. God is giving me these things. God is seeing my situation, and God is giving me these things. And anyhow, then they started building as a family. They built up the walls, and Netha suggested that we as a church would help. So we had 2 work days of building Luisa's house, and the final thing was putting on the roof on his house. But the really interesting thing is that it started raining, and the rains were falling in all the other communities, but they didn't hit El Respaldero until the night that Luisa's roof was on. Then it just poured. It just felt like, this is my son. I'm taking care of him. I'm taking care of him. And his own sister-in-law, that's not a Christian, recognized it. You know, saw it, how God is looking out for Luis. So it's just beautiful to see the faithfulness of our Lord God. And I just think of Galatians 6, how it talks about if we don't give up, we will have a harvest. And so I praise God.
And this is not working here. How's that? Okay. Are we okay there? As Marietta said, it's been quite a while since I've talked to you, so there's a bit of area to cover. I'm going to recommend that you put your seat belts on low and tight. You know, sit back, relax, enjoy the journey. If we have a crash, I've got my geeks up here. You all head for the exits quietly. Leave your hymn books behind. There have been a lot of things that have changed through the years, but there have been a lot of things that have stayed stable. One of the things that stayed stable is that we continue trying to measure ourselves against these words that define the life of Jesus. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, and to set the oppressed free. We don't meet up to that. We're continually trying to see how we can do a better job. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about tonight focuses on the medical part, but we really realize that a lot of people that come to us with abdominal pain, headaches, body pains as a whole, are coming with also unstated other issues. A lot of emotional issues, a lot of soul pain, spirit pain. So we try to continually focus on how can we help not only the physical pain, but the other parts of the pain that are contributing a lot to the kind of lives that people are living. Marietta does that by helping them benefit from the time they're waiting out in the front in the waiting room and the porch. She continues to give Bible lessons, and I threatened her that if you guys start yawning tonight, she's going to have to give one of her animated lessons. Another thing we try to do is work with literature. She continues providing low-cost Bibles, books for children in the waiting room and the exam rooms when people are waiting. We also have a number of books that people can be looking at. Interestingly, the favorite book that we have right now is one that Doris Miller sent down from her store over here. It's one of those cardboard books about the creation. It's just one of these little books, but it's bright. Just the week before I came up, a little lady was sitting in there. She's illiterate, and so has never had a book, maybe has never seen a book. I could barely get to her heart for her heart exam because she was so excited about telling me about the turtle. There's an actual turtle on this page. Can you believe this turtle on this page? It's like, well, I need to listen to your heart. Another thing that we've started doing the last several years is when people come in with a particularly distressed look on their face or with the kind of exam that says there's something going on beyond what you're just telling me, we'll often ask Marietta to start doing massages. A physical therapist was down visiting us, and she taught Marietta basic therapy, massage therapy. So she will often take people in and do massage. It's a great time for talking. Then she may pray with them afterwards. So what else is old and new in our world? Probably the biggest old thing that continues to be new and surprising is the kind of health care availability that we have. There are a lot of people in El Salvador. There's a lot of people who would pretend to care for their health needs or pretend to be able to care for their health needs. That's grandmothers and neighbors and pharmacists and doctors of all sorts are all available to care for health needs in their own way. But people who actually are able and willing to provide for the health care of the Salvadorans, especially the poor Salvadorans, is limited. Let me just show you a bit how the Salvadoran healthcare system works. On the preventive side, to your left, to your right, El Salvador does a great job at prevention. That is their star in healthcare. They send Celso is our deacon that we talked about, that Marietta talked about. They send healthcare promoters like him who may have a fifth, sixth grade education. They'll give them 6 months of 6 weeks of training and then ongoing training, and they'll send these people out to the to each home in the various villages. They'll make sure that the immunizations are given to all the children. Children run away when they see the healthcare coming with his little igloo pack carrying his immunizations. They'll make sure that the women are in prenatal care. They'll make sure that we don't have malnourished children. They'll look about hygiene. Do you have running water? Are you using your latrines? The areas that they cover have changed greatly in the time since I've first been in El Salvador. When I first went to El Salvador as a medical student, I saw children dying of tetanus, which is horrible death. I saw children dying of measles and mumps. That doesn't happen anymore. Because the funding of El Salvador's health care largely comes through the World Health Organization, and the World Health Organization is eager to have maternal and child mortality rates decreasing. Children and pregnant women get great care. They get immediate attention. Malnutrition also has, I see very few people, children who are malnourished. I see plenty of them that are overnourished. On the acute and chronic treatment, though, on the right, that's where El Salvador does a really poor job. The people who have funds can pay private physicians for almost anything. People who have employers, who are employed by employers of a significant size, can get a health care insurance through their employer. The uninsured poor will go to public clinics and hospitals. To give you a bit of an idea of the kind of care that the private pay person can get, one can basically go into a doctor's office and order whatever they want, and they'll be accommodated. We had a woman who I was trying to send to the hospital. She had terrible health care and a terrible family situation, so she was in heart failure at the age of 38 or so. Kidney failure. So I sent her to the hospital, and in the hospital, she refused dialysis. So she left and went home to die with two young children. On the way home, her husband had been very unsupportive. He'd not been a good husband, had other women, was drinking, and really not caring for her. But on the way home, he looked at her, saw that he was going to die, thought she looked a little pale. So they just dropped by a private physician's office and told them they wanted a transfusion. So on the spot, she got a transfusion. As the blood was transfusing, it clotted up. So the nurses just pushed it in, and she collapsed on the spot, went home, and died a few days later. On the other two, so private pay people, if you have money in your pocket, you can get whatever you want. It may not be smart, it may not be healthy, but you can get it. However, the other two groups of people don't get that kind of care. This is a scene from the emergency room in one of the workers' hospitals, Seguro Hospital. This looks busy and full. The public hospitals are at least as busy and at least as full. And this is our clinic. And we think we're pretty busy too. In this little room, this is where Marietta and Hannah and Patty work. This is the room where they get their charts pulled up for the day. They get weighed. They get their blood pressure taken. They also come back out here. They sit here waiting to be put back in an exam room, come back out here to get medicines, and it's chaotic. I keep talking about how full the system is. We have tried through the last 21 years to figure out how to deal with the overwhelming numbers of people that want to keep coming to us. You may remember that when we first got there, we didn't think we could see people by the appointment system because people didn't have phones. So it was first come, first serve. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, our neighbors would be wakened by people coming by, and they didn't care if the neighbors were sleeping. They were awake, and they were waiting to get to the clinic. And then the bus would come by and drop off another 30 people. And by the time I came up to the gate, about 6 o'clock, there was a mad scramble to get up to the clinic to be the first in line. That's not a really great way to work, but it's what the only options we thought we had. So when my health gave way in 2008, we said, maybe we need to reconsider this. And during that year, decided that there probably are enough cell phones around that even if the poor folks don't have a cell phone, they have access to it through their family or their neighbors. So we started going with the appointment system. Then when the appointment system started not working, we were having people scheduled, our regular patients scheduled 1 or 2 months out. Then people started saying, you know, this is not working. We can't even take care of our own patients, and we still have new people coming in. So, in our infinite wisdom, we set this rule, no new patients, until we can get our current patients completely cared for, which is impossible. So, Marietta gets the jolly job of when somebody calls in, she asks, do you have a chart here? And if they say no, she'll say, well, I'm really sorry, we're not seeing new patients. And she says that absolutely firmly, absolutely no wavering, until a guy comes in like this. Then she comes back, and she has this look on her face, and I know I might as well just say, yeah, we'll see him, because we agree on this. It's impossible to turn people away like this. And a child like this, what are you going to do? It doesn't take much to help him, and they've already been to other places. They aren't getting help anywhere else. What are we going to do? So we look at each other, and we kind of look around to make sure Rhoda isn't listening too carefully, because she'll roll her eyes, too, at what we're doing, and we'll go, yeah, we'll see him this time. I'm just going to warn you that if there are people here who have real sensitive stomachs or children who might have nightmares, I'm going to be showing a few pictures that probably aren't normally shown here in church. I'll try to warn you, but just there are some pictures coming up that might be a little medical. It was a busy day one day this last spring when one of the staff came in telling me that Hilma was starting to be really strange. She's a young woman, single. And she was complaining of not being able to see very well. She was staring strangely at other people. She was starting to have hallucinations, and the family thought she'd probably lost consciousness a couple of times. We've known her because she has been on the front porch selling these coffee cakes that she makes in her oven up to the right to support her family. And then she'll come to the clinic and sell, as you see in the lower left-hand picture. But I was concerned about her symptoms, and so I saw her that very day. And when I looked at her, she really did look at me like she wasn't seeing. I saw very clearly that she couldn't see from the outside of her vision. I sent her into the hospital immediately with a referral. The hospital sees patients through the emergency room. They're either seen by nurses or by first-year students, the first year out of medical school. So these are people who don't have a lot of experience. So my routine has been to try to give them a very careful referral, to tell them what they're looking, what the symptoms are, what the diagnoses might be, and what they should be doing to try to give people help. She went to the emergency room with her mother, and they said, come back later. To go into the emergency room, she had to borrow money, and it took a day's wage. She went in a total of 5 times to the same emergency room. I think I gave her several more referrals. I'm not remembering well. When she finally lost consciousness at home, then she was admitted to the intensive care unit. And they gave her IV fluids and watched her until she gained consciousness again. She still needed a CT scan of the head. The hospital doesn't have a CT scanner. So what the hospital does is they say, go to a private hospital that has CT scans, which cost $600, and get your CT scan, and then we'll decide what to do. She doesn't have $600. She gets, at best, $5 a day. So they sent her back to her home, and I saw her not long before we came up here, and she was lying in bed, blind, not talking, still has 2 young children, and probably she will die and will not know what caused, if she was cancer or an infection, but she probably will die. These next several pictures are ones that you might, if you have children that with sensitive stomachs, you might want to get them distracted. This woman is one of my personal sadnesses. She came in, she's the mother of Annabelle, who is our gardener, a dear friend, and we care about her mom a lot. She came in and had a corn-sized kernel on her left eye, right by the nose. You can barely see it on the picture. I usually take those kind of things off in the office. They're a cancer that can be pretty easily removed. But because of where it was right by her eye. I was afraid if she had scarring, she wouldn't be able to close her eye, and it would give her problems the rest of her life that might threaten her vision. So I sent her in again with a referral. She went in, and the ophthalmologist gave her drops and did not do surgery, despite a careful referral that said, this woman has cancer, please take it off. For reasons that I don't know, I didn't see her again for 3 years. Now, her only options for treatment, she's no longer has any options for treatment at this stage, but her only options for treatment were to get her whole eye taken out. She's not willing to do that. So this is the house she lives in, and she's blind because her other eye, she has a cataract, and I can't get anybody to take her cataract out of the other eye. So when Uncle Paul and Nancy were down to visit us this last spring, I had seen Nina Carterman in her house several times, and she just struck me as getting more and more depressed. She's blind. The house is tin. It's an oven in there, and when it's raining, it's wet. But she's gone outside and tried to crawl around, and she loses her way. She's a ways in from the road. She loses her way, and she lives by herself, so she screams, and nobody can help until Annabelle comes by. So she just has stayed in the house. Well, we decided to see if we could do something to make a guide wire for her so that she can walk out from the house, out to the road, and be with people and hopefully not be quite as depressed. We won't be able to heal her cancer at this point. Another man came in with a lesion at this size. He knew it was a problem before he came to us. He had already been to a number of clinics, and they gave him salves and those kind of things. When I saw him at this stage, I said, oh, that's a bad cancer. That's a kind of cancer that spreads to all sorts of different parts of your body. We need to get you to the hospital. And the story will sound a little familiar. He went to the hospital, and they gave him salves. When they finally operated, this is what they did. And yes, you're seeing the sinus bone exposed. And he's living, it's 2 years out, and they did a really good job with the surgery. Don't know how long he will live. So why is it so hard to access healthcare in our system? We've talked about the overwhelmed healthcare systems. There are so many people in El Salvador. and so few resources. I've talked a bit about the inexperienced physicians. They have just been through medical school, and the quality of medical schools is not what our medical schools are here. As an example, we had a microscope per student. They have one microscope per class. We had one cadaver for a physical, for learning anatomy per student, per four people. They have one per class. So they don't have the opportunities we did. The other thing is that these people are being thrown into an emergency room that looked like that one picture I showed you. They are completely overwhelmed with patients. It doesn't help. They don't benefit in any way by seeing these patients or by not seeing them. They don't ever see them back to know if they improved in their health by what the doctor did or what he didn't do. They aren't being remunerated extra. They don't get more financial benefit from seeing another patient or by not seeing him. There's no legal recourses to the patient, so they're not being punished either if they're not doing a good job. So there's not a lot of motivation for a person who's not motivated by the love of Jesus Christ to really be seeing these hordes of people. As I told you, I've tried to get around it by doing referrals. Sometimes it works. Sometimes there's really wonderful people in the emergency room. The third issue that we've been trying to deal with is the issue of what I call the culture of power and poverty. About 500 years ago, Spain came into Central America, and by using weapons and all sorts of other things, conquered the indigenous people. The power stayed in the hands of the Spaniards, and through the years, there have been uprisings trying to get power into the hands of the common people. And the people have learned that it's better to not fuss, because if you fuss, you die. So the people that we're dealing with are people who have learned to say whatever you say. And they say whatever you say so easily that it is totally frustrating. Why Nina Carmen with the eye didn't come and tell me that the doctor had just given her eye drops instead of waiting for 3 years to see me again? I don't know, except she has learned that she doesn't. It's a thing of fate. And if the doctor in the hospital didn't take care of me, then nobody else can. So what can I do? Our clinic staff continues changing. As you may remember, when we went before 2008, when I was up here for a year, I had tried to use entirely Salvadoran staff, local Salvadoran staff that we trained on site and worked well with me and with our patients and with everybody, with Marietta and everybody. But it became clear that they were feeling their limitations, because without a diploma from the government, they didn't feel free to diagnose and treat. And I didn't want to put them in a place of being vulnerable, so I didn't push them to do treatment. So in 2008, asked for nurses to come and help me, and had two nurses at the bottom. You'll see the backsides of Anna and Margaret. They're back in the States now, and Rhoda up at the upper right is helping us. You may know her parents, Leroy Miller, who had been in Romania for a number of years, are her parents. Those of you who have Salvadoran connections, she's Melissa Miller's sister. She had been a nurse in a cancer ward for 10 years, and so it's been a bit of a change for her to come from high-tech cancer ward to kind of low-tech respaladero, but she's doing a great job. And my Martha is at the upper right-hand side of the picture. She's been with us now for 20 and a half years, and she's the right side of my heart. She knows what I think often before I know what I'm thinking. Hannah Brenneman, who is a sister to Judith Nisley from Cedar Crest, joined us some years ago, a real blessing. She works at the front desk with Marianne and Patty. She dispenses most of my medicines and has more time to talk with patients about how you take your medicines, which is really important if a person can't read, how you take your medicines, what they're for. No, you can take all your medicines on the same day. No, you don't go to the pharmacy and buy another medicine. She goes through the whole spiel. She also does a lot of healthcare teaching, as does Marietta. And she's taking over my medicine ordering and the inventory, which is a huge blessing to me. This is most of our current staff. There's been one substitution. Another moving target for us is medications. In our early years of the clinic practice, we got most of our medicines down through Christian Aid Ministries. Those were donated. A lot of you helped prepare the medicines to be hand carried down in suitcases by 70-pound suitcases and then 50-pound suitcases. Well, unfortunately, at the customs, at the airport customs one day, one of the gentlemen coming to visit us, they flagged him down and looked at their suitcases, and they said, yeah, we know what you, meaning the Mennonites, and the nuns are doing. So the Mennonites and the Catholics are both in the same charity care thing, and they have us flagged. So from then on, we've been going down to small packages, 5 pounds per suitcase, and they've been fine with that when they've checked us. During the 2008 recession, we had a lot of problems with our medicine donations. Earlier, Christian Aid Ministries had all the medications that we could need with great expiration dates. At the 2008 recession, suddenly medicines were being offered to us with 2 or 3 months expiration dates, and those can't come into the country without the dates being removed. So that really caused a lot of issues. Then, about a year ago, we suddenly started having another issue. We suddenly saw that the medicines that we were ordering from El Salvador, we order the ones we can get least expensively in El Salvador, we get there. The ones that we can get less expensively up here, we order up here. But suddenly the medicines that we were ordering down there were jumped by 5 to 10 times in price within a month or two. And we said, so what's happening? And then we suddenly saw billboards going up that says, your government is working for you. Look at the decreased cost of medicines in the pharmacies. And not just us, our patients were telling us, our medicines are so expensive. So we discovered that what they were doing was they made comparisons between El Salvador and surrounding Central American countries and said, oh, El Salvador is overcharging their medicines. We're going to put a cap on the price of these medicines. So they did. Well, the pharmacies are run by the wealthy of El Salvador, and they weren't in the mood to sit back and let the poor benefit. So what they did is they took all the medicines that were below this capped price, which were the ones that we were using and the ones that our poor patients were using, they boosted the price to hit the cap. A few medicines that were over the cap, which were not the ones we were typically using, nor the ones that our patients could afford, those came down in price, but very few people in our area benefited. Besides medication changes, funding has changed. In the early years of our existence down there, I still had a lot of U.S. friends who were in close contact with me and professional friends, who heavily funded us. And for the first, until about 2 or 3 years ago, their funding and the income from the patients took care of the clinic costs. We AMA missionaries were funded by AMA, but the clinic per se was funded by these extra sources. But again, with 2008, those resources dried up and they haven't picked back up. So about 2 years ago, AMA started contributing on a monthly basis to the clinic, and that's gotten us out of trouble. So what else is new? I've talked about what isn't new. Patients' needs are not new. There have been a lot of changes in medicines and various things, but there are some new things. We're continually trying to figure out how we can expand our resources within our means to help patients get things that they should be getting at the hospital but aren't. This is Lauren Sill, who was my personal therapist when I had my hip replacement. She and Dr. Lowen, who I'm not sure if he's here tonight, he was thinking about being here, worked to get Jose's knee replaced. You remember him, and he's doing great. She's been down several times to give physical therapy to our patients, to teach Marietta a number of physical therapy skills, teach us new things. We continue talking about what else can we do that's new. So just last week, I was out with Dr. Lowen, and he was teaching me some new techniques, techniques that I haven't done, about knee injections, so that for the people who can't come up here for joint replacements, that maybe we can help them some with pain and mobility. In our own church, we have people helping. this poor woman with this hand continues doing the laundry and the cooking for her family. Laundry, as you know, in El Salvador is done by hand. And when one tries to scrub and wring men's pants out by hand with a hand like this, it's pretty difficult. And trying to pat out tortillas with a hand like this is pretty difficult. So we've tried to come up with ways of helping make these jobs more doable, but frankly, it's not so easy. So David came up with a prototype that he brought down when he came down to visit, when he and Susanna came down to visit this last spring. This particular prototype hasn't worked out too well yet, but he's continuing, he and Joe are continuing to work on it. Their problem is that they have to find something that is cheap enough to build. Marietta says that something needs to retail for $5 in order for it to sell for our people. So they're trying to come up with materials that allow a retail price for that amount. They've got to figure out what functions for us. They've got to figure out what can be locally, what supplies can be locally accessed. And we'd really like for somebody local to be able to use it for an income. So they do have some fairly tight parameters that they're working against. Another new thing is that we have just tons of diabetics. And when I say tons of diabetics, I mean that in numbers and also in gross weight. So Marietta has tried to start doing our own Weight Watchers Anonymous, sort of, non-anonymous, I'd have to say. They all sit in this little circle, and she makes everybody go around and tell what their blood sugars were that day, how much weight they've gained this last month or lost. We'll hear people clapping if they've lost weight. She's also started trying to do things with teaching new recipes. People have had a very limited diet, and their diet in the past has been aimed toward avoiding malnutrition. So if one has basically rice and tortillas, beans and tortillas every day, and you've learned to cook with fat, it's really hard to change one's tastes and also one's habits in cooking. So we're trying to figure out how to help people develop new tastes. Another new opportunity that's kind of fallen into our lap is a group from New York that does glasses, sells glasses to people in poor countries. What they're doing, though, is a rather ingenious idea. They're teaching locals how to examine eyes and then helping locals actually make an income from this, from the donated eyeglasses. So we're doing that. A final new program that we're starting is a lab. We have a very busy lab, but it's limited in its scope. So what we've done up to this point is we write for a patient, we tell them what lab we need to diagnose their disease or whatever, and hand it to the patient, and then they go and find their own lab, bring us results back, and we go accordingly. The problem is our poor patients are going to find the least expensive lab they can find, and unfortunately the quality is not always believable. So one day, poor Rhoda was in the embassy, no, was at the migrations office, and this woman comes talking to her. Rhoda was not in the mood. This was the third time she'd been spending an entire day at the immigrations office. She wasn't really in the mood for an interruption, but this lady came, told her that she was a church planter from the States that went down and ended up in medical school down in El Salvador. She's not practicing medicine, but what they have done is in their clinic, they have done a lot of networking with labs, hospitals, and other resources in San Salvador. So what we've been doing is the staff at the guest house is bringing this lab out to our clinic every 2 to 4 weeks. 50 or so patients line up to have their blood drawn. The lab takes it back into San Salvador, emails the results out to us. They're doing it for a very reasonable cost, and it really is a benefit to the clinic. Unfortunately, we still can't trust all of the lab values we're getting, but that's life. In this picture, you'll see a transition that doesn't look as significant as it probably is. In the middle of the picture, Rhoda is looking at a paper chart. Now, we have around 23,000 paper charts, and we have limited file space, and we have humid weather. And when you stick 23,000 humid paper charts into drawers, One is going to lose those. So we'd have people coming down, and they would ask me, wouldn't it be better for you to have electronic records, you know, use computers? And I thought about Marietta, and I thought about Jana, and I thought about some of the other people working there, and I thought about our national staff, which had never used, and which had never touched a computer. And I said, I don't think so, thanks anyway. Until one week, two charts were lost. Now, I'm entirely dependent on those charts. Two charts were lost. The staff spent 2 weeks looking through these file drawers, chart by chart. The rest of us joined them in the evening, and we spent weeks looking in the evening and on weekends trying to find these stupid charts, and they were not found. About at that point, I called Joshua Nisley up, who had told me before, look, if you ever can use a computer system, give me a call. I'll set up a program for you. And I had been dubious and said, no, thanks. But I called him up and said, Joshua, you know, when I told you no, I really didn't mean no. I really mean we need help. And so I went to a hotel where we had, where I could do Skyping with him for the internet. And for several weekends, he had never done medical programming, and I'd never done any electronic records. But we sat back and forth, and he said, so what do these look like? And I described what our records looked like, and he got the program going. He actually came down to be with us and stood behind us, tweaking the system to make sure that our national staff could use it and that we could all use it. He backed us up so we couldn't have crashes, and we now are entirely electronically, our records are all electronic, and it really works pretty well. It's kind of a funny, I have to chuckle sometimes because we still give our medicines out in little plastic bags, but we chart them on computers. The last thing that's changed is water. You may remember that in earlier years, one of our cries was, we don't have water again. The cows stepped on the pipes, bringing the water into the village. The neighbors are being selfish and are using up the water, and we don't have water. Well, when Philip Glick started doing well digging and needed more work, I decided we had work for him and got other people to agree. So he brought one rig up. You know, he's got really pretty uptown new rigs there and had a lot of room to work with. It was at 54 meters when he lost his bit. That's for you who think in feet, 177 feet underground. His bit was lost in rock. And that's not a good, it was his only bit. He'd done a lot of manufacturing of this bit. It was not good. So he did everything he could. He spent several weeks trying to get that bit, extracting that bit from the ground. He finally had some local people try to dig down to the bit. Didn't work. So he finally ended up coming back up here and getting a new, well, this is his new rig that you're seeing. So he went back to work. And he found water, he told me, I just checked this out, at 311 feet below ground. This is going through several rock layers. And we've had great water since then. We really appreciate it. And the last new thing is, as Marietta has already noticed, his mercies are new every morning. That's our oldest and our newest truths, and we hang on to it pretty tightly. Does anybody have questions for either Marietta or me? I want to tell you that we talk to you as family because you are family to us. We write different ones of you on a regular basis. We feel your care and your support, and we want to tell you thank you. You've been really faithful to us. Thanks.